I gave myself a haircut, but only around the ears. And like, if this continues too long, I'm going to end up with a mullet.
You probably want that, though.
Hello, and welcome to this emergency edition of the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Senator Bernie Sanders announced today, Wednesday, that he is suspending his campaign for President of the United States. He said that despite some of his supporters' wishes that he continue until the last ballot is cast, quote, "I cannot in good conscience continue to mount a campaign that cannot win and which would interfere in the important work required of all of us in this difficult hour," end quote. He's referring there, of course, to the COVID-19 pandemic. He said that Joe Biden would be the nominee, but that he would remain on all ballots and still wish to rack up as many delegates as possible in order to influence the party platform at the Democratic National Convention. So let's discuss Sanders' decision, what it means for the presidential race, and what his legacy looks like. And here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey there.
Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hey, Galen. Great to be talking about politics.
Yeah, back to a more comfortable, usual subject. Of course, though, like with everything, the pandemic...
Tinged with pandemic.
Seeps its way into it. Let's start off with this. And Micah is out today. That's why he's not here with us. Claire, to kick us off, why did Bernie Sanders drop out today, April 8th? You know, as opposed to sticking it through all the way?
Well, I think... You know, we've been hearing rumblings for a while out of his campaign that a lot of people wanted him to drop out of the race because of the pandemic and because it has been well known that he basically doesn't have a path to victory over Biden in the delegate count. We just saw a Wisconsin in-person election that was contentious and where he wasn't expected to do very well at all. And I think that there's some sense from his team, and I think probably they ultimately convinced Sanders himself, that it was not a productive exercise to continue a contested primary in the midst of all this. Now, that said, and I'm sure we'll discuss this more, Sanders was pretty clear in his dropout speech that he still was going to stay on the ballot, that he still wanted his supporters to vote for him because it was important to have delegates at the convention this summer in order to influence the party platform. So while he's dropping out, he's doing it in a very Sanders style, I think, which is kind of still punching a little bit all the way to the end.
Yeah. Nate, he said that he could not in good conscience continue a campaign that was essentially impossible to win amid this pandemic. Do you think he would have stayed in the race were it not for the pandemic? I don't know, to give you a counterfactual there.
I don't know. And frankly, I don't care.
I mean, is this pandemic politics playing out here?
Look, we had a variety of primaries conducted when the pandemic was just a faint, although very scary, supernova of a star in Americans' minds when it was not affecting how they were voting or their thought process very much. And then we had a series of primaries conducted while things were getting worse, namely in like Michigan. And then we tried to have some primaries in a very weird way, like in Wisconsin, where obviously we're in the midst of this. At every stage, Bernie Sanders was losing all the states they needed to win, usually by pretty big margins. And so I don't think you can really, in good conscience, place any blame on coronavirus for his failure to stay ahead of Biden.
Where is that blame? Like, what went wrong? Was it always destined to turn out this way once it got down to two people? Or was it failures of himself and his campaign specifically?
They gambled on the notion that they can win with their base alone. In some ways, it was a very kind of Trumpian-like play. I mean, if you go back and read their strategists, the arguments they're explicitly making a year or so ago, right? They're like, well, we have the most solid base in the party. We'll turn our people out. 25% or 30% or 35% will win a lot of states. And then it's not for sure, but then we kind of become the presumptive nominee and people kind of grudgingly come around to us. And it kind of seemed like it was working, obviously, after the first three states. And the questions were, number one, do they really have a ceiling or not? Number two, even if they do have a ceiling, can the other candidates get organized enough to overtake them, right? And the answer is yes, he had a ceiling, in part because they didn't make a lot of effort to reach out to other parts of the party that weren't very Bernie loyal. And also, yes, the rest of the party did get very organized and wound up aligning behind one candidate, Joe Biden. And as a result, they wound up losing pretty badly. If one of those things had been true and the other hadn't, say they did have a ceiling, but like there's Biden and Bloomberg and Buttigieg and Klobuchar and it doesn't get organized, then we're in our fun, quote-unquote, contested convention scenario. Or you could have had a race where Bernie does not have that much of a ceiling, but it does get organized, so it becomes Bernie versus Biden, a back and forth a la 2016, but instead kind of, I don't know, right? I think this is one of the clearer primaries as far as the why questions go. They pursued a course of action that may have been the best they could have based on the landscape they were evaluating at the time, right? But it was vulnerable to someone else consolidating the not Bernie lane, and that kind of period, like at the height of their success after kind of, I mean, I remember going to the rally in Nevada where Bernie was kind of in a kind of fun, jovial way, kind of thumbing his nose literally almost, or not literally, figuratively, in the eyes of the establishment. Right? He was like, I'm literal about my literal versus figurative, Claire.
Such but a millennial, Nathaniel.
But he was like, they are trying to stop us and they can't do it, right? You read all these news accounts, they're desperately trying to find some suitor and they're not going to be able to do it because we have people power and blah, 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 right? And I don't know, it's those rallies. It seemed pretty compelling at the time. You know, I could imagine how intoxicating that felt if you're on the campaign. Those are really well-organized events. But, you know, I think they kind of flew, in retrospect, a little too close to the sun, right? They should have used that time to say, okay, maybe I'm not your first choice, but let me tell you why I can be a good representative for the entire Democratic Party.
This is something that we've talked about for the past 4 years, I think, on the podcast. Basically, the entirety of the Bernie Sanders campaign, which I think we can all maybe agree to varying levels, never really stopped after 2016. But the idea that we brought up a lot is that a lot of nominees and a lot of eventual presidents, if you look back on our history, are people who tack more towards the center, even within, you know, like a party itself. And I think the Sanders campaign like ran a very human campaign in the sense that they ran a campaign that hewed very closely to the personality of their candidate. You know, we might be able to sit here and say the strategy that would have been better, and I think probably look, you know, hindsight being 2020, it probably would have been better for him to be more welcoming and to say, I see you moderate Democrats and I understand some of the stuff I've said in the past might scare you, but here I'm going to soften it a little bit. Here's what I really mean. But Bernie Sanders is a guy who in every period of his life has been an outsider. Up until his seventh decade, right? He is always used to punching from the outside in. Even when he was, you know, an elected official, he kind of maintained that stance. So I think it's just the campaign in many ways was an authentic campaign to the man it was behind because that person is not inclined to be conciliatory. And I think that that's, you know, maybe has prevented Sanders from being president or being a party nominee, but will make him a figure of a different kind of historical import if you kind of, you know, in 10 or 15 or 20 years when we're looking back.
I do want to get into that a little bit more, what Bernie Sanders' future looks like. But sticking to, you know, what just happened in this primary for a minute, it became clear, especially towards the end, that once it was consolidated down to two people, Biden and Bernie Sanders, Sanders was doing worse than he did in 2016. You know, he lost Michigan in 2020 by double digits, whereas he won that in 2016. Why, essentially? You know, I think that the assumption going into this was that Bernie Sanders was going to, you know, build on this strong coalition of 40-something percent of Democrats that he had built in 2016, and he was reaching out to the African-American community and more to the Hispanic community, and that he only had, could, like, go up from there. In fact, he went down significantly. I mean, why did that happen?
Well, that was a dumb assumption. But look, so first of that 40%, about a quarter of that was people who just didn't really like Hillary Clinton. And when there are only two candidates on the ballot, then they would pick Bernie. And those are mostly rural, not urban, rural working class whites. And that group, for reasons that may have to do with gender, I don't know, maybe have to do with just Hillary, those people were perfectly happy to vote for Biden. And so it's not like in 2016 where you remember like the maps. It would be like Bernie would do well in many of the rural counties and Hillary would do well in the urban counties. That wasn't true this year, right? In all these states, Michigan and Florida, well, Florida was a good state for Hillary too, right? And Missouri, states like that. Biden is winning almost every county, right? He's winning the rural counties often by as much or more than the urban counties, which was not true for Clinton. And so Bernie's 40% was really more like 25 or 30%. And then you're also competing against 27 candidates and not just one other. I was trying to look back on the things I wrote about Bernie in real time. And I really only did like two or three big pieces on Bernie all campaign long. But this stuff was pretty foreseeable, right? This was pretty foreseeable. It's not just hindsight is 2020, but the strategy is like was always a little dubious. And there's a lot of reporting to back this up too. Like he did not make that many efforts to go and build relationships within the party.
We did talk a lot about over the past few months, the strength of Biden in the moderate lane, kind of sucking away a lot of, you know, those maybe anti-Hillary voters in the primary last time. The idea that there were so many candidates kind of trying to tack to the moderate lane, and that led to a lot of competition, and then sort of Sanders being the ultimate motivator to kind of coalesce behind Biden. Like there were lots of weird dynamics that were introduced in this at one point 20-something person primary that allowed Sanders to last a really long time. And also in the 4 years since he had first run, he had become a national figure. There were a lot of the stuff was fed by who's AOC endorsing, Warren or Sanders. Ooh, she went for Sanders. That says something about Sanders' campaign. And like, you know, he's back. He had a heart attack, but he's back. You know, there was also a lot of media focus on him from, there was a huge gear up for this primary for Sanders, for attention on Sanders. So I think that also kind of maybe extended his staying power, extended the political imagination we all had where, oh, here, there is a world where Bernie Sanders could actually win this, right? And you could kind of track that sentiment up and down over the past year. There was like a really sort of spectacular up for Sanders when it, you know, there was that period of time when he was leading in the polls and then that super fast crash after South Carolina. So it's really, I mean, on a human level, what an emotional roller coaster for Bernie Sanders. I mean, the past 2 months, 3 months.
Yeah. I mean, heading after Nevada, I guess heading into South Carolina, even looking at our primary forecast model, you know, it looked like, wow, Sanders can really run away with this. And I want to ask you, Nate, this was the first time we ever put out a whole primary forecast trying to condense all of the different contests, all of the different people into a single graph set of probabilities. Looking back on the experience, how was it? I mean, I think maybe one of the main questions here is, was the chance of a contested convention maybe always a little bit overrated, given that the model just couldn't really incorporate into it how far party leaders would go or what kind of actions they might take in order to try to consolidate part of the party around a moderate alternative to Bernie Sanders?
I don't know. I think that is not a good way to look at models. I think that there's no way around the fact that you get a sample size of one. And I think people probably have made their predictions much worse rather than much better by doing too much second guessing instead of saying, okay, what are the assumptions that we make and what evidence is there about kind of literally how well we modeled reality based on more micro indicators and not like just the result? Because directionally, I don't know, the model had Biden as the front runner at first, and then it had Bernie as the other candidate who had a real shot, and that doesn't seem too bad, right? It kind of picked up this big swing toward Biden and became very confident in Biden. So like from a big picture directional perspective, I think it did pretty well. I'm not sure if the model did a good job of like accounting for the extent to which there was kind of coordination where a bunch of candidates dropped out at once. But I don't know. I mean, you know, at some point, it had a contested convention being above 50%. Excuse me, let me take that back. It had no majority being above 50%, but not for that long. And I don't know. I think it basically did a pretty good job with a very difficult problem. And again, I think like maybe we'd spend more time next time around looking at the algorithm around when do candidates drop out. On the other hand, again, there's a lot of hindsight bias here, right? In retrospect, you would say, oh, we need to turn all the kind of variables that reflect endorsements and things like that and coordination, turn those up. Well, you know, at least we left those in and they had a minor influence, frankly. Whereas if in, after 2016, you might say, okay, now we're in a new paradigm. We shouldn't look at endorsements at all. It's all about grassroots. Endorsements are actually a negative indicator, right? And we didn't do that either. We're trying to take the fact that over the course of time, primaries evolve in different ways, and like, and that you shouldn't just assume that what happened in 2016 was a new paradigm. And by the way, one other thing too is like, there were
that really wrote Joe Biden off.
Basically thought Biden's chances went to zero after Iowa and New Hampshire. And our model never thought that. It kind of always said, look, Biden is still in second place in national polls. He is one of two candidates along with Bernie who has anything resembling a racially and class-wise diverse coalition. And so if Bernie doesn't win, then you'd probably rather take Biden still at 16% in national polls and still ahead or tied in polls in South Carolina and not Buttigieg or Klobuchar or Bloomberg, who had much bigger problems. So, well, I think it's hard to assess, okay, what were Bernie's chances relative to Biden's? We're on pretty firm ground, and the model was on firm ground in its kind of belief that the group of candidates, namely Bloomberg, and even more so because their coalitions were not very diverse, Buttigieg and Klobuchar, that their chances were overrated by the conventional wisdom.
All of that's true. And Biden has always been someone who we've sort of unpopularly said, like, yeah, he still like leads in the national poll, co-frontrunner. We had lots of different ways to say like Joe Biden's still in it. I think like post Iowa, New Hampshire, there was so much talk because people could not help but point out that Bernie Sanders was a very strong campaigner and Joe Biden is not, as far as like, you know, energy level and sort of the public performance of campaigning and speechifying and all that. And so there was a lot of, you know, well, does the order of states, will that give voters a drop in confidence, blah, blah, blah. There was a lot of sort of like emotional speculation, even if the numbers never moved. And it's very understandable given the contrast between Sanders and Biden and just the way they present themselves. So just to kind of tack that in there as, you know, the emotion versus the data was kind of understandable in a lot of ways.
Yeah, we can spend more time unpacking what happened during the 2020 Democratic primary. You know, what happened in that like 72-hour period in South Carolina where Biden went from, at least emotionally, as you're saying, the underdog to running away with the nomination, essentially. But I do want to move on to the present and the future, because I'm sure we will come back to the 2020 primary at some point. So, Claire, is it fair to say that Bernie Sanders has endorsed Joe Biden?
Yeah. I mean, in his own way, right? Like, he said Biden is a decent man, and he also said, keep voting for me. So he acknowledged the reality that he will not. Honestly, you got to respect it, right? Like, it's if you're any kind of competitive person, you're sort of like, yeah, I see what's going on here. So he has implicitly sort of acknowledged that he will lose, but also wants to influence the Democratic Party platform, right? That's his whole thing. And I think that's, you know, Sanders, who has not been a Democrat, wants to put his ideology into the party's platform because he knows that he needs the institution of the Democratic Party in order to put forth his kind of ideas. So it's both simple and complicated, and it has a lot to do with just like he doesn't agree with Joe Biden about a lot of stuff, but also thinks he's a better guy than Donald Trump to be president. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in the fall. You saw Ested Herndon make a point on Twitter, which I think is the right one, which is basically this now kind of frees Barack Obama to be a surrogate. So that'll be something interesting to see as we have all this roll forward. So I think Sanders will matter, obviously, but to go back to, yes, we're talking electoral politics again, but yes, it's going to be tinged with the essentially rolling tragedy, rolling crisis that the country is under. And it'll be interesting to see what voters' appetites are for kind of people not playing along and not playing the team sport of beating Trump.
He said this before, and he emphasized it today, that Bernie Sanders, while he lost the primary, won the ideological competition, essentially saying that in polls, people agreed with him on healthcare and economic issues. Is that true? And do you think, similar to 2016, where Hillary Clinton did adopt a number of Sanders' policies, you know, as her own in the general election, that we'll see that going forward from Joe Biden?
I think a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters would like to think, we have Democrats' heart on the issues, right? But people voted for Biden because of electability. I'm not totally sure that's true, because Biden is not a Andrew Cuomo-ish centrist, right? Biden is someone who reads where the wind is blowing and positions himself to be kind of in the exact middle of the Democratic Party, not in the middle of the country overall. So, for example, although Medicare for All is popular among Democrats, a public option, which is Biden's position, is probably more popular. It is more popular based on polls. The degree to which, for example, he might talk about race, right, where he's very conscious of race and has a lot of support from black voters, right, but also not using kind of as much of the more woke kind of language that younger, more candidates on the left might use, right? And so it's like a lot of things where Biden actually, I think, reads the room pretty well. I mean, that's kind of one of his strengths as a politician. I mean, he won the nomination, right? We should kind of, and pundits in general, should kind of acknowledge, like, what are things that Biden did pretty well? Because he's not Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama as far as charisma goes, right?
He, you know, I said earlier, like, he and Sanders in their public-facing profiles were very different. But I will, I've said this and I stand by it. He's good in intimate settings with voters. He does the kind of, like, and the laying on hands type of politics. And I don't mean that to be like, there were those allegations that he inappropriately, like, or paternalistically touched women. And those are still there. And that's still out there and up for debate about whether it was inappropriate. But Biden does have this very tactile, homey kind of retail politics. It is like, he's a kissing baby kind of candidate. He gets close to people and talks to them about death. I mean, like, you know, it's very Irish. I mean, I gotta say, right? Like, this sort of, it truly is. Like, it's Irish Catholicism is, it's a culture that is very, there's a lot of focus about death and tragedy, and a lot of it is whatever, not to get into this. But Joe Biden's, you know, kind of core pull with a lot of voters is that he's a person who's weathered a lot of tragedy in his life and seems to sort of rise above. There's almost a religiosity about it, a kind of perseverance that people like. It's this sort of soaring narrative. And so he's good on that level. But yeah, I mean, consistently, to go back to the electoral strengths of Biden, he's been really good with black, you know, he's been really strong with black voters. He's kind of been the, as much as a liberal can be kind of anti-woke in their rhetoric, Joe Biden is that. I mean, you know, when I wrote a piece about Biden's particular appeal to black voters this summer, a lot of people talked about how they kind of liked Biden because they knew he was the sort of guy who would maybe appeal to Trump voters, who would be able to kind of like talk the not woke language that would bring Trump voters, you know, back to the Democratic Party side and therefore win a general election. I'm going to ramble a little bit, but there are things that Biden did really well, you know. You know, people in South Carolina said, like, Joe Biden's here all the time. He goes on vacation here. You know, he's not just like flying in. He's like, he's got a connection. And I think if you couple that with bringing Barack Obama out on a campaign trail, you know, that's not a bad duo for Americans who are scared shitless and want a comforting image of 4, 5, 6 years ago.
So do you think that given that, and also perhaps given that Biden did better than Clinton against Sanders, that he doesn't incorporate Sanders and try to appeal to his coalition in the same way that, you know, Hillary did, at least to some extent?
I mean, Joe Biden needs, his campaign, I think, would probably like to have the enthusiasm of young voters, if only because that's kind of a culturally influential thing, right? Like, the fact that he's like an old fuddy-duddy is not like a great cultural place to be in. So in that sense, yeah, I think he'd love to have Bernie Sanders sort of cultural and youth enthusiasm, but I don't know if he's going to get it. And I don't know, frankly, like, you know, I don't know how much that Biden campaign is, if the, I don't know how much the culture of that campaign is geared towards getting young voters, is what I'll say.
Yeah. So in all of this, Nate, what does Sanders's role in the Democratic Party and American politics look like going forward?
Well, it's up to him. You know, I believe that Bernie Sanders believes that Joe Biden would be a better president than Donald Trump. I think by all the reporting that the relationship between Biden and Sanders is genuinely pretty friendly, more so than one probably between Secretary Clinton and Sanders. You know, look, I think Bernie will be remembered kind of in the history of kind of a paradigmatic case of someone who does have a ceiling, someone who can win a significant minority of the party, but not a majority, and that will be treated as a cautionary tale about factional candidates, maybe particularly factional candidates on the left. Is that the correct read of it? I don't know. You know, I really don't know. You kind of do wonder if, I don't know who you would compare him to. I mean, okay, since my mind went there, like, let's say you have like a AOC who has some of the same positions as Bernie, but AOC is also a little bit more pragmatic in certain ways. And although Bernie did very well, actually, with Hispanic voters, she also does a really good job, rather than just a pretty good job, of having a multi-ethnic and multiracial coalition. And so maybe if you had a politician with a little bit of AOC's pragmatism, right, plus a little bit higher floor among non-white voters, then maybe that candidate does win, you know? So I don't know. I don't know if that reading will be correct. But I do think that, like, people are going to be like, yeah, well, Bernie did great, but it's a second place strategy and not a majority strategy.
Yeah. As we wrap things up here, Claire, what's your take on Sanders's legacy and role in the party going forward?
It's something I'm really interested to watch play out. His greatest strength has always been in communication of message and being a sort of uncompromising figure. I think in a lot of ways that makes him perhaps ultimately an unsuccessful politician on a national level, you know, getting a nomination. But I do think he will probably, if I had to bet, become something of a Barry Goldwater figure of the left, this figure of uncompromising ideology that a lot of younger generations of people on the left will hearken back to and say, my political awakening started there. I respected this guy. You know, Bobby Kennedy did it, right? Like this idea of these figures who are, you know, too good or too pure in their ideologies to make it far, whether by dint of fate or people just didn't get it enough. So I think Sanders will probably, you know, he's colloquialized the political revolution, right? I think that stuff is really powerful. And I think we're going to, you know, right now the Democratic Party still has a lot of moderate factions, right? There's a lot of older voters, a lot of minority voters that are moderate or conservative. But you do see, I think that Sanders' strength with young people is really interesting to watch and I think could say a lot about the politics of the next 10, 20, 30 years of the party, especially, you know, I guess I'm an elder millennial.
middle to elder.
Sorry, middle to elder. But my generation has been very much shaped by the crash of 08. And now we have this probably similar, if not worse, economic crisis, health crisis. There's a lot of lack of trust that's been percolating over the past 10 years that I think leads to people buying into the figure of Bernie Sanders, and that will probably go beyond. So I think it's hard to tell in the middle of an inflection point what its effect is going to be. But I do think he's like a super important historical figure. And, you know, that's what I think.
All right. Well, I think that's a good place to leave things. And of course, we will spend plenty of time covering the general election that, for all intents and purposes, we have now entered as of today going forward. So we'll leave things there.
For all intensive purposes?
Oh, God.
Intent and purposes.
I know.
April 8th.
Sorry, it's hard to have moments of
levity,
humor, and joy these days. And that was okay.
It is. It's nice. It's nice to see you guys today. It's been like I've had a past 24 hours where I've been doing a lot of reading on the internet that has made me feel sad.
Yeah.
And John Prine died, which made me really sad.
I will say, honestly, having a politics podcast that was largely focused on horse race
politics
and, like, you know, politics, ante, coronavirus, was refreshing. So thank you, guys.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Galen.
My name is Galen Droop. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. You can also find 538 on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.